R22 tout monde, antenne cadiste.
So thank you, Emily, for the introduction, and great to be here. I think I'm personally extremely excited to be here with Grada for a couple of reasons. One, because Grada, I think, as many of you, it's testament to the fact that so many people are here tonight, is one of the most exciting artists on the contemporary art scene right now. I think she's bringing a different energy, a depth of practice, an expansiveness, which I think is really, it merits close attention. So that's, I think we're going to try and, you know, get into some of that this evening. The second reason is because Grada and I, this is the second time that we've met. We met before in Stuttgart or Frankfurt? Frankfurt, for an exhibition. We were part of a panel, an amazing panel actually, with Greg Tate, the writer, Françoise Vergès, the incredible writer and curator, Oscar Murillo, the artist, myself and Grada, to talk about the artist Jean-Michel Basquiat. And we had a really interesting conversation. And then
In the exhibition of Basquiat,
exactly. So tonight, in a way, is our second kind of, you know, an opportunity to kind of develop the conversation and focus really on Grada's practice and her work. And what we're going to, I think what we're going to do, what I propose, is that we're going to kind of go into the work in the exhibition, Illusions, Volume 1, Narcissus and Echo, and also Volume 2, around Oedipus, and really kind of open up some questions around those works and talk a bit about the genesis of those works. Then I think that will hopefully lead us into a discussion of Grada's wider practice. And she has a practice which I think comes out of deep research and teaching for many years in Germany and other places. So we can talk about that. And then I think we've also got some, Emily mentioned my own research around questions around visibility and the black body. And I would really love to kind of talk to Grada a bit about that. So that's kind of what we'll do. And then of course we will open up the conversation to the audience to really, because I can see there's so many people here that I'm sure you have many questions that you'd like to bring to the floor. So Grada, perhaps we should start with the exhibition and the work in the exhibition. And these two works, Illusions, which are, have become, I think, you know, are really resonated, I think, internationally, because you're dealing with really personal issues. I was saying to you before, issues that I think as a black person living in the West, particularly within the spaces of the white cube, that people feel quite, you know, are real, and they're really, you deal with them in a very granular, everyday way. So in terms of this, in terms of Illusions, maybe you can maybe start with just explaining a little bit about how you came to that project. So Illusions Volume 1 was commissioned by the 32nd Biennale of Sao Paulo. But maybe you can just talk a little bit about how you came to that project and what you were trying to do with that
absolutely.
Project.
Well, it's also so beautiful to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you.
We were struggling to find a date that we could both come to Paris, and changing every time, and we all managed to find. So I'm so happy you made the time to come. Well, Illusions is, I think Illusions is, you know, sometimes I think there's some projects that are there in your mind for a very, very long time, and they need to become mature. And as they become mature, you start visualizing and you see the images and you dream about the images, and you have the names. I think we don't have any specific about Narcissus, but I think we can just maybe just show one of the image. If you want to click, you can. And Illusions was one of them. I was very busy The previous work, I was very busy with knowledge production and what is knowledge and what knowledge is acknowledged as such and whose knowledge is this and who can teach knowledge and so on. And then I wanted to continue this idea more into stories and which stories are told and how are stories told, what for are they told and who tell them. And I was very busy with a series of myths from the Greek mythology that I had to study them extensively, like many of us in the school, at school, but also at university, like Narcissus and Echo, like Oedipus. And for me, it was always the question that something, the stories that are being told to me, they are told as universal stories. But when I hear them, I read other other layers that are not being narrated in the story. And I wanted very much to do a work, an ongoing project on that. So it is about, again, to question what is knowledge. Because I think as an artist, I also produce knowledge, not necessarily by giving answers, but by producing works that raise questions. And this is also knowledge production, when you do a work that raises questions to your audience. They leave the installation with an awareness and with questions that were not there before. So I was very busy with this idea of bringing stories that we all know and that we've heard thousands of times, but that suddenly when you lend a new voice to these stories, you realize that you don't know them as well as you thought, or that the stories might be much more complex than you thought. And they have much more layers that include categories and transdisciplinarity, such as gender, sexuality, race, post-colonialism. There's so many layers there that have been always erased from the narrative. And that was, for me, the most urgent project. And that was a time when I was invited to the 32nd Biennale of São Paulo. And I was there, and I already had a project, an installation, but I had this idea for Illusions, and the installation of the Desire Project was installed, the opening had happened already, but we thought we still had a little rest of money that I could use to do a second work. And Jochen Voss, he was the curator of the Biennale São Paulo, and Gabi Novo was my curator, responsible for me. She did later, last year, the Biennale in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And we thought, we still can do a second work as a performance. But we don't have means, we are really sorry. And I said, so how much money do you still have left? They said, we have 2,000 euros. And I said, okay, give me the 2,000 euros, I'm going to do a new work. And then with these 2,000 euros, I only had money to do the shooting for one day. And I could only pay the studio for one day, that cost 1,000 euros. And 500 for the actors and for the camera. And we did it. We went to the studio. I wrote the Illusions, Narcissus, and Echo. And I worked with the actors, with Moses Leo, who's playing Narcissus, is my husband, is an actor, theater actor. Marta is this wonderful actress from the theater, the German theater. I always worked with her. Ze is this wonderful dancer, choreographer, who's also a camera person. So we went, the four of us, to the studio, and I put the images together. I packed the hard drive with the images and flew to Brazil again, and edited the film and presented it, and then we installed it there. That's how it came. But it became very urgent while I was in São Paulo. The idea became clearer and urgent, and I responded with this urgency of doing the work with very little means, also because when it was suggested to me, I was in Brazil and I felt how important it was to do this work with no matter what means. It became very urgent, this question of misrepresentation and invisibility. And for me, Narcissus and Echo really represented this story. Narcissus is this character who falls in love with himself and is always reproducing its own image. And Echo, this character, was punished by a goddess and could not speak, only repeat the words of the others. So this dynamic was so urgent for me to bring it into a artistic work and to speak about this invisibility and this lack of voice and how we live in a space, in a society that always make you invisible and where you do not have the voice. That became very urgent for me in São Paulo when I was there, where as an artist you are put in these very luxurious hotels and that are cleaned by black people only, where the elevator, there are people in the elevator pressing the bottom so that you can go up and down. And there's a door in the front for the main guests, there's a door in the back for the servants. And you are confronted with this architecture that is such a racial architecture, and it becomes so painful to move there. So I made also that decision in these circumstances that I said, of course, I'll do a work about Narcissus, that I have to. So we did, this is how it came, this first work of that was there for a long time, but it became real in a moment of urgency where I thought this is very important. That would be decadent to say, I'm not going to do it. I don't have enough money for that. Yeah. So,
I mean, perhaps we'll have a look at a clip actually to sort of see the visual language, because I would like to kind of unpack a little bit about the visual language that you use in this, in this, and look at the various elements that make up the work. Because even here, if we just look at this kind of the basic elements of the image, the first thing that strikes you is the overwhelming whiteness of the surround, which you call the kind of white infinity. And that's a really strong part of the series of the illusions. And so it brings up that question of whiteness, which is what is white. Because sometimes people, when we talk about the post-colonial and the decolonial, people often focus on the black body. And of course, on a white background, the black body becomes even more pronounced, becomes even more in focus. But that kind of background, normally invisible place, is something that I think is a really important part of the work. So you've got this white infinity, then you have, the black body, you have various, the way that they're costumed, there's elements of costume, there are various props, you can see kind of cloths being tied, there are symbolic elements to all of your films that kind of relate to this idea of myth as well, because the Greek myths had lots of symbolic elements, right? What we're not seeing at the moment is the soundtrack, and there's a music soundtrack. There's also yourself on another screen, basically narrating the story of Narcissus and Echo, and explaining that, and then opening that up. So there are various elements and that constitute the language of this movie that I think we can break down. Maybe we should just have a look at the
white infinity.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's I think for me, one of my practices challenges is I find it very interesting to think how to translate theory into artistic practice. So how do all these books that we read and we know and we write, how do I translate this knowledge of white privilege, of the white cube, of the black box, of whiteness as an unmarked identity, as an absent center, as an identity that is at the center of everything, but the centrality is not seen as relevant? How do I translate these into into visuals or into a choreography or into a narrative. So that's for me what I'm mostly busy with. So for me, I thought that it would be very important to create in this project to have an idea of that it is urgent to interrupt or to disrupt the white cube. The white cube is this space that presents itself exactly as neutral, as universal. It is an absent center. It is... It presents itself as this objective space where everybody can tell their stories, but it is not. Then it's the question that I asked before, so but which stories are told here? How are they told? And what for? And who tell them? So to narrate, choosing this white infinity, I work in Berlin at Neukölln in Kreuzberg. There's this very old studio that has no corners, and these studios with no corners, they are round like the skaters, you know, without corners, and that visually creates this sense of infinity. So it was a very expensive studio every day, because it creates this very special, it's a huge space where you can move around, and the perfect space to work with the actors. And this is what I wanted. I wanted to have this white infinity, this sense of white infinity, that even if unconsciously you realize that you have these bodies moving in this space, a white space, that suddenly becomes marked in the film. So what is usually seen as unmarked becomes visible here. By becoming visible, you also question, you realize which story is being told and who is telling and performing this story. So there's all these elements, this dialogue between the white cube and the black bodies, and of course the contrast with the black box where you project everything, and the white cube where you see everything that presents itself as neutral. So I wanted to play with that in the first place. So
should we watch a little bit?
You want to? Yes. So maybe I can just tell you. yeah, let's go. But then, yes, then comes the music. I just wanted to tell you this part. This is very. We did some small clips, and this clip, all the clips we sing, unfortunately, are from Oedipus. We didn't prepare any of Narcissus, and I think that comes again to this point: why this story? Why do you want to tell this story? And for me, the story of Oedipus have been always told as a story of the Oedipus complex. It's been used and abused as a story of sexual desire and of the boy who loves the mother and wants to kill the father. And then it was very important to transport that into now and to say, how do I see this story as a black woman? And so the story of Oedipus is basically a story about violence, but it's also a story that tells us much about politics of violence and of genocide. So this is how this story evolves. We will talk about it. Just like Narcissus is a story about white privilege, and it depends to whom you lend the voice to tell that story. So this is this twist of the story. And what you're going to see here is when King Laius, who's dressed in red, the actors, when I work with the actors, we all dress in black and we are barefoot, without shoes. And we dance and so that we can move comfortably. And then I just put one or two materials just to show who is whom. In this case, is King Laius became a father. And his son, it was told by the Oracle of Delphi that his son, if he becomes a father of a son, this son will one day kill him and remove him from power and will kill him and will marry his own mother. by knowing that from the oracle, he has decided to kill his own son. So he wrapped some his ankles that you see in red and asked the herald, his servant, to bring the child to die in the mountains. So this is what you're going to see with the music of Neo Muyang, and then we will go there. It was an amazing opera composition, a compositor from South Africa who I've been working with for all the illusions. But then we can also talk about the music. So this is Shilapa. Say then the whole work goes from chapter to chapter. So Queen Jocasta and King Laius have sent a son to death, and the herald of King Laius, who's here performed by Zed Paiva, have decided to disobey the power, disobey the king, and instead of leaving the child to die, he brings the child to another kingdom. So, yeah.
The music is so haunting and beautiful. How did you work with the music? What you know? Because I know that you're editing. You actually edited the films, and I understand that the way that you edited the film was also in thinking about the music and the soundtrack. Maybe you could talk a bit about that, about the importance of the music and how you worked with that to produce the visuals.
Well, the music is amazing because Neo Muyanga is amazing. He's an amazing artist. Mm. So is this composer from mostly opera composer from South Africa, and I had the privilege of meeting him, and also in 2016 in São Paulo, we did an artistic residence about Massa Revoltante. Massa Revoltante was a revolting mass, and he and I was invited to come together with other artists to talk about music and words as of protest. And in the music, in the work, in the visual work, and etc. And then, and we just liked each other so much. It is a wonderful person to work with, and we have decided that whatever we do, we would like to come together. And I had this idea for Illusions, so I asked him to. The concept for me was to have for each volume always to have the same scenario, the same actors, the same music composer, and one single music. This music then, we kind of broke it down, the music. So you have one single song that then sometimes you hear only the piano, sometimes you have the drummings. We edited the music and repeat it or mix it, but you only have one single music that it has different elements in different parts of the story. But I also wanted to have the music along with my voice as two performative tools, for one very simple reason. I use a lot music in my work as a form of narrative, and I wanted to give this importance to music as a voice, that narrates something. Because also historically for the African diasporas, music have been a political tool and a form of narrating history. Remembering that many spaces, many white cubes in many physical spaces, we could not enter that spaces physically, but we could enter the space through music. We have been occupying many cubes and many spaces through music only. Only the music was allowed. So the music has also been used historically as a form of narrative, as a discourse. And I wanted to bring this element into the visual installations, that sometimes I narrate along with the music composer. I tell the story, I stop, and he continues with the piano and tells the story. Then I continue with the voice, but it's always very playful with the voice or with the music. But I wanted to bring this this importance of the music, that is not only music, but that music has been indeed for the Black movement a form, a very critical form of discourse and a narrative. And that not always is taken serious, and I wanted to bring that element. And I think when Moses and Martha meet the Oedipus and Jocasta meet, then Neil is only playing the piano. I think it's a good moment maybe to see the music. Do you want to show that one? Should we? Let me see, so that people really can follow.
That scene also brings up that sense of movement and choreography. And I wondered how you work with choreography, because, I mean, obviously the whole setup of the work is very theatrical, and there's a sense of theatre and dance and movement. And just the way at the end the actress kind of was laughing, it was almost quite spontaneous. You know, how much of it was actually planned choreography and how much of it was improvisation, you know, and what is the role of movement and choreography, you know, in your practice and in the work?
Well, I think theatre and choreography really play a very important role in my, as well as writing and the voice. And I think try to bring all these different layers together to tell a story. I love dancing. I find dancing absolutely beautiful. I find storytelling absolutely beautiful. I find it fascinating how a voice can bring you to tears, or someone singing can bring you to tears, or it can bring you into a mood, can guide you into a certain space. That you play the piano and you know, the movement of the body, the storytelling, all these, I find very fascinating what we are able to do with the human body, how we can evolve someone to understand something through the art of the sound and the movement and the visuals. I find that very fascinating. So I think when telling a story, you cannot tell a story with one single discipline. I think all these different elements ask you to come, to be there. And so choreography is also one of them. When I write a story, I first write a story. It's a very long process, actually. it's a very long process, first of research, and then it goes into the writing of the story. Then I create the images of outer stage with which actors who should play what and how they should look like. But basically I go from chapter to chapter and I see what are the conflicts and how could that be visualized through choreography or through the visuals. Or in this case, for instance, I use this paper. It's a very thin red paper. You can buy it everywhere, but it has as a symbol of blood, of violence. So you have to create a symbol, a metaphor for the story you are telling. And then when we go to the studio to shoot, I go chapter by chapter and I tell the actors. They know the story, and then I go, okay, now we're going to do this part of the story when he falls in love with him and her, with her, and this and that. And then I would like to film that. And then we start playing. And I always leave the cameras on. And usually I use the parts, or I say, okay, thank you, that was good. And then they continue. And usually the part after the cut, that's when you use it. So that's usually like that. But we start with a plan and then I let it run and we play around. And many times they also, the actors contribute with beautiful things. And I think then at work, you have to see, I think you have to see your work as a rehearsal, as a laboratory. It's nothing, I like to work with this idea of the mistake, that nothing is perfect and you are experimenting. And the work that comes out comes from the part of the experimenting. That's the parts, those are always the best parts that you use to the film. But we improvise a lot. I have an idea, we start from there, but we all have the liberty to change it and to let it grow into something else. And usually that's the best part, actually. So,
it's interesting, because we talked before about the minimal aesthetic. In terms of just to think about the aesthetic language at the moment, you've really reduced, it's a lot of subtraction of elements, right? So you've taken out the background and it's just this whiteness, this burning whiteness. And you've got very basic, you know, like the black costume, there's an element of colour, which is almost painterly, it's very graphic, almost painterly language with the ribbons. But maybe you could talk a little bit about the overall sense of cutting down, of being quite minimal. Why was minimalism or why was a minimal aesthetic so important for you? In what is really a very traumatic, you're talking about trauma, talking about bodily trauma, you're talking about, you know, something which is normally associated with excess and with stress and with drama, and yet you've kind of portrayed it in a very minimal way. So what's behind that minimal kind of aesthetic that you're driving to?
Well, without thinking much, I like things very minimal. I don't like to be bombarded with a lot, too much information, too much signifiers. I always feel that when I'm bombarded with too much, it's because people don't know what they want to tell me, mm-hmm. or what they want to do. When I'm given something very minimalist, and it becomes very clear for me and very strong, very intense. I always had that experience. So I'm the kind of person who appreciates this minimalism, this clarity. Of what is to be told. I think I use this very minimal aesthetic also because I wanted the audience to focus on the storytelling. We didn't talk about it. Maybe we will talk, what is this storytelling? To listen to the storyteller, what is she telling? And to focus on the conflicts that the actors are performing. I think when you don't have much around, you can focus, you can really dedicate your attention to the actors, they become very visible, they become very prominent. And I think this is something that for me is very important. But this morning we also talked about is the politics of visibility and invisibility, which I think is also a beautiful song. We will come at the end. Yes, and then we will talk about it as well.
We've been kind of focusing on the work. I want to now extend the lens of analysis to talk a bit more broadly about your practice, right, and where your practice comes from. Because in a way, this work, or at least the volume one, Narcissus and Echo, in 2016, commissioned by the Sao Paulo, but was in a way your first introduction to the wider art world, right? Yeah, and 2016. But I mean, behind that or before that were many, many years of research, of writing, of scholarship, which is underpinning this practice. So I really want to kind of talk a bit about that now, because one of the things that I understand about your work and I appreciate about your work, and as a researcher myself, is that a lot of, you're talking about storytelling. Storytelling is essential to it. But what it is, in a way, is about knowledge production. That is something that I know runs throughout your work. This idea about who speaks, how do we speak, who has permission to speak, goes back to the fundamental questions in Western philosophy, in Western epistemology, in how we understand how knowledge is produced. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, how, where you come to this in terms of your early studies and research. You studied in Lisbon in clinical psychology and psychoanalysis, right? So I've got to be careful what I say, because you might break down, you know, some in certain ways. But maybe just talk a little bit about, you know, how you came to these ideas, you know, because where I'm trying to get to with this is to see how you moved from the written word to the visual, because that's kind of what you've been doing. A lot of this is a translation of your philosophical, psychoanalytical research, which is collected much in your book, Plantation Memories, in 2008, and then now moving into the visual. Maybe just start a little bit about your early research and your early kind of work around thinking about the politics of knowledge.
Well, yes, it's been a long path, actually. I did enter the... Plainly, I entered the contemporary world, art world, 2 years ago or 3 years ago. But I've been working since more than 15 years. Mm-hmm. So there's this trajectory. And when I look back, I think the work that I've been doing has always been a very hybrid work, where I bring together many different disciplines, and I always felt that my work can be presented everywhere and nowhere at the same time. That's the kind of work I always did. I started by studying clinical psychology and psychoanalysis, and dancing as an hobby. Doing psychoanalysis, which is something I really love.
Did you practice at all?
I did. I practiced for many years. And I love it. I find it beautiful. And I thought psychoanalysis is what is closer to art, because you work with the unconscious. It's the only psychotherapy that works only with the unconscious. That means with the symbols, with the metaphors, with the dreams, with the visions. It works with a language that does not have to be real. It works with the translation of internal fears into a metaphorical language, and that is fascinating. That's what you do with choreography, that's what you do with visuals, with painting and with sculpture. It doesn't have to be real, it is real in an internal world, And very early then I started working with war survivors in Lisbon. It was still a war for many, many years. So I worked a lot with women and children in and with trauma, and I was very, very interested on writing these stories, and I was very interested on the narrative of these stories. And I was...
She's also a link with Fanon, right?
It's very
because Fanon was working,
exactly.
France Fanon, of course,
France Fanon. Was
working in that context of the trauma of colonialism, trauma of war.
Absolutely, and I remember having this this professor of psychoanalysis that one day came to me because, of course, we had this very white program, and she came to me and said, "Oh, I have a book in my office at my house. I would like you to come over to pick it up.
Better have a look at this."
And I said, "Okay, I come." And I called her, and I came to her house. And then she went to her office and she was searching, and she had Franz Fanon in French, and said she studied in Paris for many years before, and she had Franz Fanon in French because it still does not exist in Portuguese. And back then she had that, and she said, when I was studying in France, in Portugal, no. No. Yes, in Portugal, not yet.
Not in Portugal.
We are always a little bit later. we have a 5 years behind, maybe, in the publications. So back then, it existed in French, and not in Portuguese, exactly. Mm. And of course, French is just like Portuguese. You can read it and understand everything. And we are forced to study French also at school. So all these colonial languages that we know, French, German,
layer
English,
upon layer.
Exactly, Spanish. And she asked me to come, and she was this lovely psychoanalyst, and she gave me the book, and she said, "I think you're gonna like." I was doing my diploma, my last thesis, and she said, "I think you're gonna like it very much." It was the first work on Black identity, and I was devouring the book. I think I read it. I don't know. Yeah. Timeless. I read it again and again and again, and then I bought it in English, and I read it again, and I needed to read it many times until I really understood what he was doing, and that became an intellectual mark for me. I think Franz Fanon was one of the most influential intellectuals for me that always confirm the importance and the urgency of the work and the complexity of the work. And that was really fascinating. But one of the things that fascinated me mostly with Fanon was this difficulty, this hybridity, that it transgresses disciplines, that you don't know where to place it. And I thought, that's it. That's what, when people don't know what to do with the work and where to place it, it's a signal. This is what this rebellion to obey to a discipline, but to be in between many disciplines that people don't know where to place, in which platform, that's exactly what decolonizing work and decolonizing knowledge means. When you work transdisciplinary, when you bring all these different layers into one, because one story cannot be told in one single way, and one identity cannot be narrated in one single way. There's all these different layers that must be very hybrid. And he was this fascinating author that was a psychoanalyst and was a poet, and you read and he's complaining, and then suddenly he gives this deep analysis, and then he writes a poem. You get all confused in his book. You don't know. It's something I never saw before.
Confusion.
Yeah. It's something I never saw before, and I thought, this is fascinating. This is so brilliant. And he really brings this decolonial practice in this book. And that was a very big inspiration. So from there, I started writing a lot and publishing, and I started lecturing. I received this PhD from the German government, so I left Lisbon immediately with a big joy. I was very happy to leave because I wanted to grow. I wanted to find new languages. I wanted to find the books. I wanted to find my language.
But that's sad in a way that you couldn't do that in your home country, in Lisbon.
Yeah, it's a fact. It's okay. It's okay. Yeah. I think we have to go where we have to go.
Of course.
And maybe we can then return later with a language. But I think it's very urgent for a lot of young people that feel they cannot find a language in the place where they are to define themselves. Sometimes it's very important to leave. This is very interesting because then I wrote Plantation Memories, and we are now in the process of translating it into Portugal and to Brazil. So we're translating a work that was written in English into Portuguese. And it's been a nightmare to do that because we realize how problematic the Portuguese language is, that all the terminology is defined, it becomes masculine, for instance. But he's written by a woman, and then the text itself becomes a contradiction. It is a language that only has feminine and masculine. So you're always writing in the form of a duality of genders, instead of dismantling this duality of genders and being transgender. So you have a terminology that is mostly colonial. So you would have no escape. Even the correct words like negro is a colonial word. So it becomes so problematic that you don't know how to move in the. And it's been a nightmare and challenging at the same time, because we have to challenge and to rethink how to write, or at least to make always notes for the audience that speaks Portuguese. This is how we speak our language. Now imagine, what does it mean to not be allowed to exist in your own spoken and written language, or being identified as an orthographical failure? Because when I look at the translation and I changed into a feminine or into a word without gender, it becomes identified as an orthographical failure. So this is the violence, the power and the violence that is transported exactly in the language. So these are all these different aspects that, for instance, with Fanon's work, I became very aware, and I became very interested on bringing them into performance. How do you bring all these thoughts and all this knowledge, not only printed in the book and not only remaining as an intellectual knowledge, as a cognitive knowledge that you have here, but the rest of the body cannot connect with the knowledge that is cognitive? And that became very clear for me when I was teaching at university one semester after the other, and I had these very obedient students who read all the books and had all the books and essays, and they knew everything, but they didn't know what to do with that knowledge. And that's where it came for me, this interest of translating this knowledge into performance. How do I bring these texts into a performative, into the visuals, into the voice, the music? How do I bring this into another dimension that does not remain only in the head, but that really can embrace you as a person? So more and more, each project, one after the other, was in between many different disciplines in that sense. Yeah.
And what I was going to say is that if you go on Google and Google Grada, and there's an interview that you did with the German TV, which actually has a clip in it from a documentary that they shot of you teaching in Berlin with the students. And it is an amazing video, because it shows you the way that Grada completely challenges the the kind of, as you said, the teaching with the head, the way of understanding knowledge as something which is a very cognitive, disembodied practice. Whereas what you're trying to do, you've got students to stand up. In the video, you see the students in pairs talking to each other, not talking to them, actually not speaking. And you were walking among them, giving instructions or kind of reading sort of aspects of the text. And it was that performance of identity, that performance of a more emotional embodiment, which came through as a very, you know, and the students were interviewed afterwards saying, you know, this is, I've never had this in the university. This is not the way that I understand normally how you would communicate knowledge, you know. So again, that the kind of performance that you have kind of produced here, you kind of like trialed that. You kind of, your classrooms were a laboratory for that kind of sense of translating the text into performance through embodiment.
Yeah, I think so. It was always so beautiful to work with the students. They're amazing. I mean, they are just amazing. And they need so much someone who challenges the concepts of knowledge that were given to them. They know they need other knowledges and alternative knowledges. So one of the things I did with them, it was very beautiful because at that years, I was having this professorship at the Humboldt University in Berlin. So we would go all together and we'd go do around a tour at the university to see the statues and the sculptures that are inside and just to observe them, all of them. And they realized for the first time after many years that the entire building is habited by sculptures of white men with a head and a neck. So we came back to the room to think, what does that mean? And we started the seminar with the idea of disembodied artists, mm-hmm. disembodied theorists, and how this is linked with the patriarchal and colonial knowledge production. Someone who's in power and who's disembodied, who creates knowledge from the head to define others, to create the others. And this knowledge is disembodied of the rest of the body, of the heart, someone without a body, without a heart, without hands, without sexuality, without gender, because that does not play a role in the knowledge production when you are dominating. So, and we were dismantling that. What does it mean that you are asked to produce knowledge without positioning yourself? So we started by creating texts, writing texts. And I always told them, you can only write a work in my seminar if you start by doing an introduction, why of placing yourself, from which time, which place, from where are you writing? And why are you writing this? Why is this urgent for you? That you have to place yourself in your work. And this is something that we still see very much then in the art production. We had for a while a lot of white artists exploring blackness and performing blackness without positioning themselves in the work. And there's this exploitation of blackness in the work. And this is exactly that, this dismantling of privilege, and to say, so, but who are you? From where are you writing? So we started with this idea of what is disembodied and embodied. And then we had these most incredible texts from all these authors, from Fanon, bell hooks, Audre Lorde, all of them. Audre Lorde lived in Berlin. Du Bois lived in Berlin and taught in Berlin. Berlin is also a very special city with many radical minds living there. Angela Davis, Grace Jones. So you have all these black women and black transgenders who live there and really left a very important legacy in the city, and really influenced the thug. And then we would come from the text into performance, into exercise, it was very, very beautiful. So I think it was a path until until here. Definitely.
We're going to open it up soon, but before, because I'm sure you're dying to kind of come into the conversation, but before I do that, I want to make two quick points. One is, in some respects, I think, Grada, your work, Plantation Memories, and your other, you know, your performance work goes beyond Fanon in the important aspects of gender. Because in some ways, I mean, Fanon is a foundational work. To understand the psychology of colonialism, he opens that space. There's no doubt about that, right? There were people like Manoni who did that, but Fanon did it in a way relating to blackness, in a way which we're still really trying to work with that text. But a weak point for me of Fanon was, I think, was in number chapter 2, about the black woman and the white man, where he worked with very kind of problematic ideas of gender identity and the motivations for the black woman or the mulatto woman under colonialism, right? And I think in your work, it's really, you really kind of extended that. You've really brought in the black feminism, and taking that as a central part of your work. So I can't let you go, especially, you know, without talking a little bit about your relationship to feminism and in black feminism in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you.
No, am I wrong?
That's a wonderful compliment. But, you know, Fanon, like many other authors from the past, I think you are absolutely right. He left an important legacy to think. But like many other important movements and authors and artists, there's this aspect of gender and sexuality, and that was always left behind. I think this is very much, it comes to as a response of what feminism and the importance of black feminism. I think then that's exactly where it comes from. It comes from this lack that we inhabit in between discourses. We are at the periphery of all the discourses. We have a feminist discourse that divided the world into men and women, and never acknowledged a 500 years history of colonialism and slavery and oppression, racial oppression. So you are included in the discourse, forgetting that black women have been the servants of white women in a system of colonialism. So you are ignored in the feminist discourse, and the post-colonial discourse is mostly a male discourse that was focused on post-colonialism and decolonization, but the bodies of this decolonization were male bodies, so all the other genders are not part of this discourse, and you have a discourse on class where race is not important. So what black women, black queers, black transgender really created an alliance that, for instance, I think Audre Lorde, as a black queer intellectual, is an example of it, that was able to bring this interdisciplinarity and this very complex view of what feminism should be about, and that racism and anti-racism must be obligatory part of any movement of liberation. And if anti-racism is not part of any of a movement of liberation, then is automatically excluding a big part of the population. So that's where it comes from this genderized feminism, gendered racism. Some feminists then started naming it gendered racism or black feminism, but it was really an alliance where then suddenly categories that were never included in other discourses then became prominent. And I think to work from this vacuum, from this emptiness, to work from the works in between and to be at the periphery of the periphery. I think that's this element that I find it very beautiful to say that was used for many years, that then black women, black queer, black transgender occupy a kind of the otherness of the others, because we are neither white nor we are male. So we cannot compete with those in power in any way, not with the masculinity of the gender or with whiteness like women do, white women do. And it's this space of the otherness of the other, and it's a space of the periphery, of the extreme periphery, which then many authors like bell hooks say something very beautiful and saying this is a space of possibility. Exactly, this place of margin is the place where the questions are raised that could never be raised at the center. The knowledge, the critical knowledge, comes from this place of the periphery, of those who really raise the most fundamental questions and challenge the center and challenge the dominant discourse. So I think very much. That's maybe why some of the most radical but also touching work come from black artists, black female artists, that they really come with questions that are not always posed by other artists who are closer to the center. And I think it's this place of this vacuum that becomes so important in the work as well, I think.
And of course, there is, from I understand, there was a conference here at La Colonie about black feminism. Pascal is here. Unfortunately, I wasn't there to witness that. But it's obviously a discourse which is continuing. And I've got like 10 pages of questions to ask. But we wanted to talk about visibility. But I really do think at this point, we need to open it up to you guys to kind of come into the debate, and maybe we can wind in some of the questions of visibility. Please, let's do that.
We just show this last one, yes, as a response, maybe as a response to what we just said now, and how to make this visible.
The conversation. I've been following Rada Quilomba for a long time. I think I heard about you by Miguel Valde Almeida, is a Portuguese anthropologist that divulged an article about you when you exposed in 2017 in Casa da Índia and MAT and Museum of Architecture of Lisbon. So I'm really interested. And well, my question is about, you were saying you felt free when you left Lisbon. I'm also an immigrant in Paris. I'm Portuguese, and I also felt freed for when I left Portugal, because it's, as you said, it's good to leave where the place where we were born, to see elsewhere in other languages. So my question is, knowing that Portugal had five African colonies, how do you think they are dealing in the past years in the political context and in the artistic context? You have Calafé Palanga, who is he was founder of Buraca Son Sistema, right? So he was a band of Kuduro, who is worldwide known and marked our generation. So he kind of expanded Angolan style, music and style. So my question is, comparing with Germany, who didn't have that much of they were in Africa, but it wasn't the same thing as Portugal. How do you see the political and the artistic context in the last few years? Do you think in Germany they are more open to artists, and how is the discourse in the social life, in the daily life? It's difficult to see. I don't know, the people, black people taking action, having a voice.
Thank you for your question. It's so complex, isn't it? It's such a complex question, and I don't know. I live in Berlin. Calaf Epalanga also lives in Berlin. We are almost neighbors, and we meet many times. You probably saw, I also invited him to be part of this artistic work. He's the second performer liberating himself from the violence. So he came as a guest artist for the chorus. I usually do that for the chorus. I always invite one or two people to join, extra to the actors. And I think I showed the work for the very first time in 2017 in Lisbon and in Portugal. It took a long time. And I think it's very symptomatic where we are, because I think the colonial history has been very present, but we have also been nourishing our identity and narratives on the colonial history. So it's a history that have been very romanticized and glorified. And that really does not allow and does not give space for critical voices and critical works to have a platform to exist. So I think that's why then many artists and thinkers, and especially black artists and thinkers, then decide to leave. And this is what happened to me some years ago, because I wanted to find a language. And I wanted to find myself in a language. And when I say language, it's not a language French, German, English, or Kimbundu. Is a language, a critical language that can speak, can dismantle and can speak my reality. And I found very much that language in the postcolonial studies, which is mostly documented in English. I had the big honor to meet Stuart Hall, to be invited by Paul Gilroy to show my work at his seminars, to meet all these people that I knew I could never meet if I was in Lisbon. I had the chance, I was invited to teach at the university. I know we still don't have black professors, or very few in Lisbon. So there was all these opportunities that were very important for me to become another person, or maybe even better, to find myself. I needed very much to find myself. And I think when you are dealing with questions of race, of gender, of sexuality, you need to find spaces, safe spaces, that can offer you a language to find yourself, to become yourself, knowing that most of the languages alienate you or pathologize you. So that was very important. And I applied for a fellowship for PhD, and I lived very anonymously in Lisbon. I was the only black student for many years. Then I started working at psychiatry, and of course I was also the only black professional there. And I was very often, people confused me with a cleaning lady, or they refused to get inside the office with me with closed doors. So there was always a challenge to see a black person in, or black woman in a power position, in a position of knowledge, in a position of someone who has the power of definition in a country that has defined the entire world. So so we are talking about, when we talk about knowledge production, we're also talking about dismantling the notion of power definition, who has the power to define what and from which perspective. So for me, it was very urgent to leave, even though I find Lisbon such a beautiful city. And I love to go there and have a coffee and go to the beach. But to do the work that I do, you know, I need to live in a critical space. And at that time, Berlin was great. I arrived in Berlin and I've met this movement of black people, of black Germans that were highly influenced by Angela Davis and by Audre Lorde, who have dismantled the language critically, who were working in intersection with sexuality and gender. I was amazed with what people were able to do there. Then I went to London, I've met all these people, and this is what I needed and searched. So I think each one has to do their path. But when I found my language, when I wrote this book, Plantation Memories, that Paul mentioned, that I wrote, it was published 10 years ago, it was the place where I first found my language. It was the first time that I wrote something. This is who I am. This is what I need to hear and to read. And why was that possible in Germany, even though it was published in English and so on? I think, this is my theory, I think that in many other countries, dismantling racism is a process. I would say it's a process of five steps. It starts with denial, guilt, shame, recognition and reparation. We usually, in between, we are usually in denial. And when I arrived in Berlin, I arrived in a space that was jumping between guilt and shame. And this guilt and shame is a very important process, because shame, you ask yourself, who the hell am I? What have I been doing? And how come I do not know this? So there's a moment of insight, of reflection, that leads you into recognition. So this moment of guilt and shame allows that many platforms change and transform the agendas. While I was in Lisbon, like many other countries, probably like France as well, that glorifies the past, the colonial past, and based its narrative on the colonial past, and is in the constant denial of history, and in denial of the brutality of history, of course there's no space for these books and for certain exhibitions and certain artists. That's how I experienced it back then. So for me, Berlin was this very ugly space, this very ugly city. It's a very ugly city, very dirty. It's not romantic, it's not nothing. It's just very ugly. And that's the charm of Berlin. You really live very anonymously. It's ugly and people like it like that. And that's why David Bowie was there, and Grace Jones, and all these punk artists were living there, because it has this element that is, I don't give a fuck. It that's the sign of Berlin. And it is quite it is quite it's not Paris or Lisbon, but I like it like that, and I personally needed that revolution, that element of revolution, to be able to produce the work, this kind of work, a critical. You cannot produce this work on the beach.
Can I ask in Portuguese? Because my English is bad. And eu posso falar em português e depois a gente tenta traduzir. Porque eu não falo... Na verdade, eu tentei falar inglês e... Eu queria te perguntar... Boa noite. Sobre a ideia de afrodiáspora. Porque quando você falou sobre sair de Portugal e ir para outro lugar, eu pensei na diáspora. Se tem relação, o que você pode falar. E eu queria também perguntar... Porque o Frantz Fanon, ele fala que ele só foi sentir o racismo quando ele chegou na França. E eu no Brasil, eu passo por branca. Em alguns espaços, eu passo fácil por branca. E aqui na França, não. Aqui na França, eu fui saber o que é racismo. E eu queria que você comentasse sobre essa questão da passibilidade, da racialização. Porque na França se fala muito le racialiser. E agora? A primeira questão... The first question is about Afro-diaspora. The second question is about the racialization, because in Brazil I'm almost places I'm white, but in France I'm not. And e uma terceira questão é sobre as cosmogonias iorubá, porque eu vejo uma cosmosensibilidade muito forte. Eu sinto um santo ali. And the third question is about the cosmosensibility. In the cosmogony Yoruba. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. <It's> Obrigada. You see, you speak very good English. Well, I think I'm going to talk only about the last one. Is that okay? Because you already answered the other ones. You asked and answered at the same time, so... It is indeed, in all the works, in all the works, there's a kind of a spiritual dimension in it. So I also see this, the performance, also it has something, a ritual and a choreography that I find it has a dimension of spirituality. When I did this work, I knew that I would like to explore Oedipus as a story of the politics of violence. It was also a time where I was reading a lot about the Black Lives Matter, where I was reading a lot about how many black people, especially black young people, have been killed and are still being killed or incarcerated around the world. It's really a mass incarceration and the genocide of black people. For instance, in Brazil, several thousands of young people have been killed only last year. So we are already talking about a black genocide. Before I started this project, there was also some violence in Lisbon from the police against a community. So I've been very busy with bringing... How do you bring this topic of this legacy and this continuity, where does this come from? This politics of constantly killing black people. How come the black body becomes so vulnerable, century after century? It becomes a body where violence is performed. Where does this come from? Why is the black body read in our society as a body where violence can be performed and exercised? A body that can be easily killed. I was very busy with that. And I thought the story of Oedipus was the best story to bring these, the politics of genocide. How does it, how come that we create the politics of the subhumans, that we create, we dehumanize people and say they are less worth and therefore they can be easily killed? Where does this come from? And the story of Oedipus starts exactly with that, with this innocent child who was just born and is sentenced to death. And is always facing death, and it's a cyclical and reproductive oppression. He cannot escape his destiny. He wants to know the truth, but he cannot escape his destiny. And this is one of the elements of the story, that it always comes again and again. And with that, with this work, like with other works, then I always search very much which is the Orisha, the god or the goddess in the Yoruba mythology that tells this story. And for each work, there's always a orisha that accompanies the story and comes symbolically in the colors. And indeed, Yansan Oya was the element that always came, that is liberation. That's why I did the scene at the end. Yansan is the goddess, is a warrior, and is the goddess of the wind. Each orisha, each god lives in a natural element, and Oya lives in the wind. She comes and blows and takes away everything that destroys us and cleans our path. But she also brings what should be next to us. So she's the one who liberates, and that's why I also created that image that all the actors are tied like Oedipus in the ties of violence, in the ties of blood, and then they open and liberate themselves. At the entrance of the installation, we had 11 beads, because 11 is the element of Yansan Oya, Caída 11, Vitória. Vitória is liberation, is victory. So there's all these elements that always make part of the installation. That means Yansan will come and will clean us from this violence. Victory will come. Caída 11, Vitória. Então, so this is how I worked. In the Narcissus and Oedipus was mostly Oxum on Iemanjá present. They are other goddesses that deal with image and representation. So there's all these different layers and knowledge production that come in the work. Thank you. Indeed. Thank you.
My question is based on the scale of your work. I saw it at the Goodman Gallery in South Africa. And seeing this work, I can just imagine it the same in a way in another space. And I think at Goodman, you offered a space for movement, since you speak about dance and your work is based on elements of dance. And the music also, right now listening to it, you know, it offers me movement more than just sitting and listening to you. I mean, listening to the video and also listening to you speak about how Naomi Yanga composed it, you know, and I've heard his music before, and it doesn't let you just sit and just listen to it, which usually that's what we kind of walk into the spaces and we're supposed to do, you know, to sit and listen. If I just walked in here and started dancing, I could just see myself as a problem and being too visible at the same time, you know? But you offering me that space, you know, to move, to do something, to interrupt the space if I have to, because the music wants me to dance, the hand gestures wants me to do something. When I saw them with the sticks and the blankets, that makes reference to most of our cultures in South Africa. And I want to say, you know, do something. Yeah. So basically, I wanted to ask also, the element, there's an element of play in your work. And is that political? And how is it political? Is it supposed to make me political as a viewer? And how I respond to the work.
It's quite beautiful. I think in the work, I think there's many different layers in the work. I think the work also brings into the gallery, into the white cube, something that usually is not there. And then you as an audience question yourself, how should I behave in this case? It starts already with the length of the work. We talked about this morning. About this work, for instance, is 45 minutes. A video installation usually is 2 minutes and 14 seconds. And usually you only see 1 minute, and after you see 1 minute, you already saw everything and say, oh, okay, I understood, and you move on to the next one. So it started with that you prepare an installation. Sophie was also asking me today, but why are you sitting next to it telling the story? Why are you performing? Because this is not a film with a voiceover. This is a storytelling. A storytelling, you have to install a space and invite people to come. It's a storytelling based on the oral African oral tradition of storyteller, the griot. There's a woman who sits there and people come to listen to this woman. The woman has to be present. She's a storyteller. She tells a story. You have to listen to her, to look at her. She reacts to the images. The images are the projection of our imaginary. She tells the story and the images appear. Imagine that you have the power of sitting there listening to this music, to this woman, the storyteller. And as she tells the story, the images emerge in front of you. That's the imaginary, the projection of the imaginary, in a screen projection of the imaginary. So there's all these elements. Then she stopped telling, and comes the music with Neo. There's all these elements. It's about recreating the storyteller, the storytelling. How do you want to be there? Then I like this idea that then you create a space or an installation where you raise these questions, because otherwise you don't have to ask this question, how should I sit, how should I look at this work? And I think that happens exactly when we start decolonizing knowledge production and artistic practices, when we start bringing and creating new languages. And that's what I mean with new languages, not the language, but these languages, formats, languages that really invite audience to think or to create new concepts of knowledge and to create new concepts of being. And I think that's very, very important. If you want to dance, you should dance. If you want to sing, you should sing. I think everything is allowed. But I think the idea that the work can raise these kind of questions, that are protocol, you go to a museum, you don't speak. You sit and you don't speak. And usually, and you don't touch. And what should be inside the white cube? And how should it be? And, all these questions, that why is the storyteller there? If I can hear a voice, why is she also present there? All these questions I find really beautiful that a work is able to raise. And this is what I spoke at the very beginning about knowledge production. When you do art, is that you create a work that raises questions that might have not been there before. And that you leave the installation with questions, with new questions. And by that, you are producing knowledge and new knowledge. And I find that very fascinating. What you want to do, it's your decision, not mine. I see my work as a worship. I do it, the ideas come, I produce it. And once it's done, I deliver it where it's asked. Emily asked me to bring the work here, and Bruno and Monica and Sophie, and I bring it. It's like a worship. You deliver, and then the audience takes it. It's not mine anymore in that sense. So you do what you have to do.
I'm not sure if my question is about form or politics, or maybe both, but could you please rephrase or re-explain what you think is being performed in your choosing to restage a myth, a story that is supposed to explain your life,
a myth that has been turned into maybe a dozen opera, I reckon, or maybe 10 opera. Or to put it more simply, why use this Greek myth to? Because you've been talking about reinventing language or creating your own language, but on the other hand, you're using something that is written and very precise and very, very already written.
Yes, but that's exactly the challenge that I wanted to take. I wanted to take these kind of knowledge and these kind of stories that are delivered to us, all of us, as universal, but which are not, or which can be read in many other different layers and usually are not. So it's about bringing these very universal stories that not necessarily I wanted to be studying them, but I was forced to, like many of us, because, for instance, the Yoruba mythology was forbidden at school and it does not exist and it's not documented. Like the languages, we had to learn French, German, Spanish and English, but not Kimbundu or Sotho or Zulu or whatever. So there's this knowledge production or this epistemic violence of what you should know. And then it's about the challenge of dismantling that knowledge and to lend a new voice to that knowledge, to that story, and actually to bring another knowledge that is inside that story, but it's not narrated. As I said many times repeatedly, then the story of Oedipus becomes a story of the politics of genocide. So you tell the story as it is, but you bring and you create elements that give you the link to the politics of violence and genocide. And then there's a twist. After you tell the story, there's a twist, a second part of the story, which is also the practice of the griot. The griot was a storyteller, kind of a living archive, who knew all the songs, who knew all the stories, who was with whom, who married with whom, which kingdom what, and which songs exist. And then had this very critical voice and dismantled what it seemed that we knew to bring other layers, such as gender, race, sexuality, to bring other narratives inside that narrative that usually and never became visible. And while doing that, that's when you are creating a new language. So basically it's like looking back, like the scenario itself, looking back at the white cube, that is a white cube. And then suddenly you create a scenario in a certain way that you ask yourself, but why is the white cube a neutral space? And what is neutral on it? So what is usually presented to you as neutral and objective and universal, then through the artistic practice, you are able to question that neutrality and that universality. And you see the many other different layers through the many different narratives that come to it. And that's exactly the challenge that I wanted to go through. We are now preparing a third volume to open at the Bild Museet in Sweden. We're doing a solo with the three works. And then it's going to South Africa, to Johannesburg afterwards, and before to Berlin. And we are preparing the next one exactly to explore an element of a mythology that we all know, Antigone, and then to transform this Antigone into the politics of justice. So it's this challenge of the universal into the particular.